This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
Hi, I'm Mary Beth Holman.
I'm Jeff Nugent.
Hi, I'm Michelle Corbett.
I'm Gus Allen.
The Grocer, a Washington ghost story, retold by S. E. Schlosser. It was a very hard time for the newlywed couple. The Depression had hit hard, and the young husband was desperately seeking a job to support his new wife, without success. He had no training himself, and all the entry-level jobs for which he might qualify were snatched up as soon as they opened. Finally, the young husband decided to use his last few dollars to travel to Seattle and look for work. His wife did not like this idea at all, but said nothing in protest, even though she had just learned that she carried their first child. There were no jobs in eastern Washington, so what else could her husband do? She didn't tell him about the baby. That would be more pressure than he could bear. She just hugged him goodbye and nodded tearfully when he told her he'd arranged a line of credit with the local grocer so she would be adequately fed and sheltered while he was gone. The young wife hated buying on credit, but the old man who owned the grocery was very kind and did not mention the growing debt to her. Instead, they chatted about local events and the weather. She learned from her neighbors that he was supporting several needy families in this way, which made her feel a little better about the situation. The days were long and empty for the young wife. She kept the tiny house spotless, but she was increasingly ill from her pregnancy, and she mostly stayed home. After 2 months, she reached the limit of the credit her husband had procured for her. Feeling wretchedly ill and too proud to beg the grocer to exceed their line of credit, she eked out her meager supplies until she had nothing left, not even fuel for the stove. By then, she was so depressed and weak from hunger that she huddled under the bed covers for warmth and stayed there as much as possible to keep from freezing to death. Several miserable days had passed in this manner when she heard a knock at her front door. She was weak from hunger and shivering with cold, but she got out of bed anyways and shuffled to the front door. When she opened it, no one was there. But on the stoop there were two boxes full of groceries and enough fuel to last for the next month. She fell to her knees, overwhelmed by such a gesture. Her husband must have gotten word to the grocer that he had enough money to extend their credit. And bless the man, the grocer had delivered the supplies right to her door. With shaking hands, the young wife pulled the heavy boxes into the cold house and had her first meal in days sitting on the floor by the front door. She was very careful with the food and fuel, for winter was upon them and she had to make it last until her husband returned. But no matter how little she ate, the supplies dwindled too quickly until she had eaten every last morsel and the fuel was gone. She would have to go to the grocer in the morning and see if there was any more credit, she decided after her last meal. That night, she was seized by a great pain. Within a few minutes, she had lost the baby and lay ill in bed for several days afterwards, unable to move further than their tiny bathroom, which stood right beside the bedroom. She was weak with pain and hunger and miserable in spirit when she heard a rat-a-tat-tat on the front door. She propped herself up against the pillows weakly, her heart springing up with hope. Was it her husband? No, he wouldn't knock. But the grocer would. Wearily, she dragged herself to the door on hands and knees. She feebly pulled herself upright on the doorknob, ashamed to appear before her visitor in such a bedraggled state, but unable to do anything about it. She opened the door. Again, no one was there. But the expected supplies were on the stoop. She cried with relief as she pulled them inside the door and shut it against the cold. Bless the grocer. Bless him and her husband who was providing for her from afar. Soon the house was warm and she was feeling better. The food helped her body heal from the lost pregnancy, and within a couple weeks she was ready to venture out of doors. She was determined to go to the grocery store and thank the proprietor who had delivered to her door when she needed food so desperately. Donning her hat and best dress, she walked out into the fresh air of early spring and made her way slowly to the grocery store. To her complete astonishment, she found the shop locked and the windows papered over. The store was closed, and obviously had been closed for some time. A woman passed by, asking the young wife if she needed help. The young wife turned to her in some distress and asked her about the grocer. "Didn't you know?" the woman replied. "The proprietor of the local grocery store died just before the New Year. We've all got to go all the way into downtown Spokane now just to get supplies." The young wife blanched and swayed when she heard this news. The woman, alarmed, asked if anything was wrong. The young wife shook her head, thanked the woman for the information, and slowly began to walk home. The delivered groceries had come from this store. She had recognized the boxes they were delivered in, and no one else in the area knew she was in distressed circumstances. Indeed, she had no friends or family in the area to turn to. So who had delivered the groceries to her? She already knew by the prickling sensation along her arms and the back of her neck. There was only one person who could have known that she was quietly starving to death in her little house, the dead grocer. And by some miracle, he had kept faith with her and her husband, delivering groceries to his starving wife after he himself had passed away. A few days later, the husband returned without money, but with seeds enough to start a garden. By the time the grocer's final gift had been used up, they had food coming in from their garden, and the husband had found part-time work enough to help them through the rest of the depression. But the young wife knew she would never have survived if it hadn't been for the generosity of the Phantom Grocer of Spokane.
The Ghost That Followed Me Home, a Virginia Ghost Story, retold by Essie Schlosser. I have a fascination with genealogy, which is what started all the trouble. My next-door neighbor and I were fellow hobbyists, and we often supported each other's search for long-lost ancestors. We would spend hours poring over stacks of dusty country records, wandering through poison ivy-strewn graveyards, and getting lost on back lanes trying to find the homes of retirees who remembered what our forebears were like way back when. On this particular day, we were traveling to a distant graveyard, which conveniently happened to contain the graves of ancestors from both of our completely unrelated families. Cheryl's great-great-aunt and her other kin were quite easy to find, but we had to search high and low before we found the tomb of my third cousin once removed, one Samuel Beauregard Smith. I took a rubbing, recorded his information into my copious notebooks, and then stood examining the fancy stone for a few moments. "No expense spared here," I said to Cheryl. "Either someone really loved him, or someone was glad to see him go," Cheryl agreed with a grin. "Do you have any idea which it was?" "Nope. I just found out about his existence last Friday," I replied. We packed up our stuff after that, lunched at a quaint little tea house in the vicinity, and then went home. The early evening proceeded normally, at least it did until I heard the squeak the front door made when it opened. Now, I knew I had shut the door firmly when I came in, and I was pretty sure I locked it, but when I went into the hallway, the door was wide open, as if someone had just walked in. Behind me, Soot, my black cat, started to purr. She walked delicately toward the front door and started twining herself around and around, as if she were rubbing against someone's legs in greeting. But there was no one there. My arms broke out in goosebumps, and I hastily shooed Soot away and closed the door. The cat continued to purr and leisurely walked into the living room, as if she were dogging the footsteps of some invisible presence.
In the living room, Terry, my ancient fox terrier, huffed a greeting to a very empty-looking spot in the middle of the room, thumping his tail a few times before settling back down in his basket to snooze. I hurried away to the kitchen to do something normal, like the supper dishes, and then went right to bed, telling myself I was being over-imaginative and silly. The next morning, some of the cabinets were open, as if someone had been searching through them, looking for breakfast food. Pretending that I must have left them open last night, I hadn't. I closed them and ignored Soot's purred greeting to someone who just happened to be occupying the empty chair across from mine as I ate some cold cereal and got ready for work. I also pretended not to see the unfolded newspaper on the kitchen table as I grabbed my keys, and I absolutely did not see one of the pages start to turn as I walked out the back door. For almost 2 weeks, I ignored the invisible person living in the house with me, although it felt like a he, drove me crazy, leaving cabinets open, scuffling up the rugs, rearranging the furniture to suit his fancies, and forgetting to turn off lights. But when he started whistling off-key, I'd had enough. I told Cheryl about my unwanted guest. She'd been reluctant to believe me until she came over one morning and found someone invisibly reading the newspaper. After that, she gave me the name of a psychic, and I gave the woman a call. Cheryl wanted to be here when the psychic arrived, but she was called over to her daughter's house to babysit, and so she missed out on the grand entrance. The psychic was a nice, normal-looking brunette who stiffened as soon as she entered the house and said, "Yes, you do have a ghost," before I'd even had a chance to take her coat. We sat down in the living room, and the psychic quickly made contact with the spirit. And what do you know? It was Samuel Beauregard Smith. Apparently, he'd seen me visiting the graveyard and decided I reminded him of his first wife, so he followed me home. "I'm flattered," I said carefully, "but it isn't seemly for a widow to be sharing her home with a bachelor such as yourself." As the psychic relayed my message to the ghost, I heard Cheryl's car pulling into her driveway and knew she would be over any minute. "Samuel has agreed to leave the house," the psychic said. I wondered where his spirit usually resided, but decided it would not be appropriate to ask such a personal question. A moment later, a feeling of emptiness filled the room. "Samuel is gone," the psychic told me. After thanking the psychic and paying for her services, I escorted her to the front door, just in time to see Cheryl hurrying up the front walk. The two women nodded to each other as they passed, and then Cheryl burst into the hallway. "Was that the psychic? What did she say? And who was that old-fashioned man with the white mustache who came out of your front door just as I was pulling into my driveway?" My mouth dropped open in shock. Closing it, I swallowed and sat down rather abruptly. "What is it? What did I say?" asked Cheryl, alarmed by my pallor. "Nothing," I said slowly, beginning to grin. "You just saw Samuel Beauregard Smith leaving the house at my request." Now it was Cheryl's turn to sit abruptly. "Samuel Beauregard Smith?" she asked incredulously. "That third cousin of yours with the fancy tombstone?" I nodded. "I just saw his ghost," she said. "You just saw his ghost," I confirmed. For the first time since we'd met, Cheryl was speechless. I laughed suddenly and got up. "It will be nice to have my house to myself again," I told her, and went to the kitchen to make us some tea.
Tolling of the Bell, a Prince Edward Island ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. In the wee hours of Friday morning, October 7th, 1859, when all the good residents of Charlottetown should still be sleeping in their beds, a deep bell tone was heard from the bell tower in St. James Church. The somber sound rang out over the rooftops, waking many with the unexpectedness of its doom-laden ring. Then a second toll rang slowly overhead, followed by a third. Bewildered by the unexpected tolling of the bell, two neighbors who lived near the church hurriedly joined forces in the road outside their homes and went to investigate. Above them, the bell tolled for the fourth time, and again for the fifth time. As they entered the churchyard, the bell tolled for the sixth time, and the front doors of the church swung open with a windy blast. Framed in the doorway were three glowing women dressed all in white. The men gasped, unsure if they were seeing real women or angels. Overhead, the bell tolled for a seventh time, and the doors slammed shut as quickly as they had opened. The men raced to the doors and tugged on the handles, but they were firmly locked. When they peered through the windows, the men saw a glowing woman in white ascending the stairs to the belfry. The minister and the sexton arrived at that moment, demanding to know what the disturbance was about. The neighbors told the new arrivals what they had seen, and the minister unlocked the door to the church. As they entered the vestibule, they saw no sign of the women the neighbors had seen in the doorway. A quick glance through the church revealed not a living soul. As the men ascended toward the belfry, the bell tolled for the eighth time. They ran up the stairs, determined to confront the culprit and demand an explanation. When they reached the top, they found the belfry empty and the bell rope tied firmly in place, though the metal of the church's bell was still vibrating slightly. Puzzled and frightened, the minister and his companions searched the church from top to bottom, but it was completely empty. As the bell gave no further sign of tolling, the men left the church, mystified by what had happened. That evening, the local passenger steamer between Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island, called the Fairy Queen, failed to arrive. The people of Charlottetown learned a few days later that the ship had sunk, killing the eight passengers who had boarded her that day. It is said that the bell of St. James Church tolled eight times on the day of the disaster, thus foretelling the doom of the five men and three women who would board the Fairy Queen later that day.
The Bells, a Mexican ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. There once was an evil priest who did not fear God or man. His duties for the church included counting the offerings and ringing the bells to summon people to Mass. But his heart was filled with greed, and he began to take advantage of the good people of his parish. The priest stole money out of the offerings to keep for himself, and when he had filled a chest full of gold, he killed a man and buried him with the chest, so the murdered man's ghost would guard it. Anyone who tried to dig for the treasure would be devoured by the skeleton of the murdered man. The evil priest planned to return to Spain with his ill-gotten treasure, but he fell ill with a fever a week before his ship was scheduled to leave. On his deathbed, the priest repented of his crime. He swore to his confessor that his soul would not rest until he returned the gold to God. The priest died before he could reveal the place where the treasure was buried. As he gasped out his last breath, he said, "Follow the bells. They will lead you to the treasure." The padre who attended the dying priest did not heed his words, but the sweeper who was working in the hallway at the time of the evil priest's death was struck by the notion of buried treasure. He was very poor and wanted a better life for himself and his family, so the sweeper determined to take the treasure for himself. Each night for a week, he took a shovel and dug in the monastery gardens, searching for the priest's treasure. He found nothing. One night, the sweeper was awakened from his dreams by the sound of the parish bells ringing out loudly in the darkness. He leapt to his feet, fearing some emergency, and then realized that his wife and children had not stirred in their beds. Remembering the evil priest's last words, the sweeper felt sure that the mysterious ringing of the bells was for his ears alone, to lead him to the treasure. Taking his shovel, the sweeper followed the sound of the church bells up and up into the hills. He was gasping for breath when he reached the source of the sound. He was on a wide ledge overlooking the valley. Two trees guarded the spot, and it was beside these trees that the glowing, ghostly church bells hovered. Taking his shovel, the poor sweeper dug a deep hole among the roots of the trees. After several moments, his shovel hit something hard. Eagerly, he swept the dirt away from the object and found a small chest. He hauled it out of the ditch with trembling hands, placed it on a rock, and broke the lock with the edge of his shovel. When he opened it, Piles of yellow gold met his dazzled eyes. He gathered up a handful of coins, reveling in the weight of so much money. The coins were cool to his touch, and he felt the smoothness of the metal as he rubbed the coins together between his fingers. And that was when he heard the moaning. Looking up, the sweeper saw the skeleton of the murdered man whom the evil priest had buried with the treasure. It was rising out of the pit under the trees, eye sockets glowing with blue flames. "Mine," the skeleton intoned, stretching its bony arms towards the sweeper. "Mine." The sweeper screamed in terror and leapt away from the box of treasure, dropping the coins that he held in his hands. He ran down the hill as fast as he could, the skeleton in hot pursuit. Behind him, the bells began to ring again as he fled for his life from the ledge. The sweeper kept running long after the sounds of pursuit ceased and did not stop until he reached his home. It was only then that he realized he had left his shovel back with the buried treasure on top of the hill. It was an expensive shovel, and he could not afford to lose it. Waiting until daylight, the sweeper went reluctantly back up into the hills to retrieve it. When he reached the ledge, there was no sign of the skeleton, the chest of money, or the hole he had dug the night before. He found his shovel at the top of a tall tree, whose first branches began nearly 20 feet above his head. The skeleton must have placed it there, after it chased him down the hill. He decided grimly, knowing that there was no way he could retrieve it. Turning sadly away, the sweeper's eyes was caught by a gleam in the bushes near the rock where he had placed the treasure chest the night before. Carefully, keeping his eye on the place where the skeleton lay buried, the sweeper felt around the rock until his hand closed on 2 gold coins that the ghost had missed. Casually, he put the coins in his pocket and hurried from the ledge. When he got home, the sweeper put the coins into a sock and hid it under the floorboard for safekeeping. The sweeper never went back to the ledge to retrieve the evil priest's buried treasure, though sometimes he was still awakened by the mysterious sound of the bells. He knew it would take someone more pious than himself to banish the ghost of the murdered man and reclaim the money for God, but he did use the gold coins to send his eldest son to school, and with the leftover change, he bought himself a new shovel.
Dispatched, a South Carolina ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. There was something odd in the tone of the dispatcher's voice when he called to tell me a person needed picking up at Bramlett Road late one summer night in 1947. I shuddered when I heard the name of the street. I did not want to go anywhere near that area, especially at midnight. But I drove a yellow cab, and it was my job to pick up a call when it came. So I swallowed and headed toward Bramlett Road and the slaughter yards. I'd been out of town when the incident happened. I call it an incident, but it was murder, plain and not so simple. A fellow named Brown, who drove a cab with our company, was robbed and stabbed to death in his cab. Next day, a man named Willie Earle was picked up by the police and put in jail for the crime, although he denied doing it. Then a bunch of hotheads who drove cabs for our company gathered together, passed around a bottle of whiskey, and talked about getting the fellow who'd stabbed Brown. One of the men went out and borrowed a shotgun, and the mob drove to the jail, grabbed Earl, and threw him in the back of one of the cabs. The hotheads took him to the slaughter yards, and they dragged Earl forcibly from the cab and started beating him. A man pulled a knife and waded into the mob with it, and Earl shouted, "Lord, you've killed me!" That's when the fellow with the shotgun put a bullet in his head, reloaded, and shot him twice more. When the mob was sure he was dead, they climbed back into their separate cabs and fanned out, each one heading back to the city by a different route. Eventually, word got out, and 31 fellows were arrested for the crime, but they were all acquitted by a jury of their peers. After the incident, The slaughterhouse section of Bramlett Road got a bad reputation. No one in the cab company much liked driving there, especially at night. Folks claimed it was haunted by the ghost of Willie Earle. I shivered as I pulled onto Bramlett Road and slowed down to look for my passenger. No one was there. I parked the cab and got out to have a quick smoke while I waited. All at once the temperature around me plummeted. I froze in place, suddenly terrified as someone moaned in terror from the other side of the road. The sound scraped my nerves raw. I could hear the unmistakable thud of hammering fists, and the darkness was filled with swirling black silhouettes pounding on something, or someone. I fumbled for the icy cold door handle as a man shouted in agony, "Lord, you've killed me!" I threw myself inside the cab as a gun exploded, cutting off the man's cries. The shot was swiftly followed by two more. I squealed the tires as I spun the cab around. A tall, battered figure that glowed just enough for me to see its lolling head. The blood-stained, dead features, the knife-torn clothes blocked the road in front of me. I gasped, floored the gas pedal, and swerved around it, heart hammering so hard it hurt my ribs. I was still trembling when I slammed into the office a few minutes later and told the dispatcher I was quitting. Then I grabbed my things and headed for home, lickety-split. There was no way I was going to Bramlett Road ever again. And I never did.
Listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.